Okay, welcome back, everyone. It's great to see everybody in the black boxes. I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order and have Ms. Hansen, if you're here, take the role.
Yep, I'm here. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel?
Keel, present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Moeller?
Present.
Representative Noir?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
Last but not least, Representative Schumacher?
Thank you. Schumacher, present.
Thank you, sir. You have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We do have a quorum. Sherry, can you test your audio one more time for us? I think we can hear you now.
Okay. I've lost you altogether. Let me try and go out.
Sherry, we can hear you. Can you hear us? Ninya, can you mute Sherry until she's up? Thank you. Vice Chair Bonner, would you like to make a motion to move the minutes from February 15th?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the minutes from February 15th of 2022.
Thank you. Representative Bonner moves the minutes from February 15th. Are there any corrections or comments on discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, members, today we have two presentations. The first presentation is on home and community-based services. This will be presented by Elise Bailey from DHS, the budget director, and Christy Graham of DHS. I'm not sure. I think Elise Bailey, are you going first? There you are. Welcome, Ms. Bailey. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Hello. Hello.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Elise Bailey, and as Chair Schultz said, I'm the budget director for the Department of Human Services. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Christy Graham, the legislative director for our Community Supports Administration. We're going to get the slides up here quickly. So I'm excited to be here today to talk to you about the Home and Community-Based Services or HCBS spending plan. I'm excited to talk because it really presented a historic opportunity for the state to invest a large amount of resources into the home and community-based services. And so I'm excited to celebrate the good work of this committee from last session that resulted in this historic investment. Also important to speak about how this opportunity could be built upon as you consider solutions this session to workforce and other challenges experienced by this sector. So today we'll provide a brief overview of what the HCBS spending plan is, what has transpired through the federal approval process since the HHS bill passed last June, provide a few key implementation updates on specific initiatives within the plan, and highlight further next steps. So as you can see in this first slide, as I said, the HCBS spending plan presented us with a historic opportunity to invest significant resources into our system. Home and community-based services are vital supports that help people with disabilities, older adults, and other people needing care to receive services in their own home or community rather than in institutions. So in March of 2021, the federal government passed the American Rescue Plan Act. And within that law, there was a provision that provided states with a time-limited enhanced federal match to Medicaid claims for home and community-based services. Then in May 2021, CMS sent us guidance that detailed how the state would be able to receive the additional funds. That guidance detailed how home and community-based services were defined. They were defined much larger than we had previously expected. It also detailed what the state had to do to receive the enhanced match. It wasn't an automatic receipt. And it detailed how we were required to actually spend the money that we would receive from that match. So this late-breaking guidance paved the way for our end-of-session collaboration between the House and Senate to identify and appropriate resources for the spending plan. The final HHS bill included over 50 unique initiatives for the spending plan that encompassed over $680 million. Next slide. So the plan is financed through a temporary 10 percentage point federal match increase, or FMAP as it's called, to eligible services that the state pays in Medicaid between April 1st, 2021 and March 31st, 2022. As I said, that amounts to about $680 million. CMS requires the state to then use that same amount attributable to that on eligible activities that expand, strengthen, or enhance the HCBS service system. The total revenue on the increase has to be spent by March 31st, 2024. So we have a few years at least to spend it. We have to also demonstrate that we're not at the same time reducing provider payments or access to HCBS services during that time. States are required to submit a spending plan to CMS that details all of the initiatives that we plan to spend the money on, and they have to approve it before we're eligible to receive the revenue. And then we are required to submit quarterly reports over the time period until the total amount has been spent. Next slide. So the bill passed late June, and the department had to very quickly turn around all the items that were included within that bill by July 12th to submit it to CMS. So we submitted it on that date, and then on September 22nd, we received partial approval of the plan. So partial approval enabled us to begin implementation on some of the items in the plan that were approved, but it also required us to submit a significant amount of additional information to CMS as they considered the whole plan in its entirety. We did not receive full approval, or conditional approval as it's called by CMS, until January 24th. And that conditional approval, now that we've received it, enables us to begin implementing all the activities within the plan based on the conditions that are prescribed by CMS. It also qualifies the state to receive the temporary 10 percentage point increase in the FMAP. So quickly, the conditions that are put forth in this conditional approval include a requirement that the state undergo the traditional applicable requirements within the Medicaid program. So many of the items are changes to our state plan or waiver plan. And in addition to this HCBS spending plan approval, we also have to get approval through those traditional processes. And so even though the plan has been approved, we do have some of those changes still pending through that traditional process. The conditional approval also specified that one particular activity titled Increased Support for Substance Use Disorder Services, or SUD services, is approved in the plan. However, payments provided to institutions for mental diseases, or IMDs, would not be a permissible use of funds unless the state can demonstrate that the payments support institutional diversion or community transition, or otherwise support the intent of the American Rescue Plan Section 9817. So this activity within the plan does include rate increases for providers participating in the 1115 SUD demonstration waiver who agree to meet nationally recognized evidence-based standards. It also includes an add-on rate for SUD providers that provide culturally responsive programming, disability responsive programming, and programs involving childcare. So the state is currently assessing what this conditional approval means and next steps related to federal approval. We're also assessing whether a legislative change could be made to exclude these items from being contingent upon the plan. Next slide. Excuse me. So as you can see in this slide, it just shows like the total amount of revenue that we are expecting based on the November forecast is around $686 million from the enhanced match. And as of the November forecast, all of those 50 plus items within the plan, we're expecting to exceed the amount that we're required to spend. We're expecting to spend about $713 million. I would also note in this table, this only shows through the FMAP period or through March 31st, 2024. And many of the initiatives that you funded in your HHS bill are actually ongoing changes that are funded through the general fund within that time period. So many of these improvements, it's good news that they'll continue to improve the HCBS system beyond this project. So I'm going to quickly highlight what is in the plan. As I said, there's over 50 items in the plan, so we're not going to go into detail at this hearing about each particular item, but I will highlight a few of the themes that we have within the plan, and then my colleague, Ms. Graham, will go over some key updates within a few of the items that we're implementing. So the spending plan includes many provider rate increases that enhance, expand, or strengthen access to services. We also have a category within the plan that expands particular services or types of services available under our Medicaid HCBS program. We have several proposals that help support people receiving home and community-based service to live in their own homes. We also have several items that plan for and implement reforms, so different studies and different systematic reforms that in the future can help expand, strengthen, and enhance our system. And then lastly, we have a category in the plan of investments that help support and strengthen the HCBS infrastructure, like providing grants to providers and advocates. The next few slides kind of go over each item in the plan. As I said, I'm not going to list, go through them all, but I thought members of this committee, it would be useful to at least see all of the various items within the plan, and happy to answer questions at the end if you have particular questions that we didn't go over about items within the plan. Go to the next slide. So lastly, before I turn it over to Ms. Graham, I just wanted to kind of note on particular items within the plan that provided a starting point for deploying strategies to address the direct care staff workforce shortage, as that is one particular challenge that the committee is grappling with this session. Over 60% of the spending in the plan is in rate increases for HCBS providers. The majority of these rate increases have been implemented at this time, with a few still pending federal approval. You also passed a historic PCA rate framework bill that provided a 10% rate increase to PCA services. This also included cost reporting for future rate reform in the space and was an important investment that the legislature can build upon going forward to fully funding the rate framework. This PCA rate increase was implemented on October 1st, and the development of the cost reporting is underway. The plan also includes provider capacity grants, so it's about $25 million in grants to providers to increase the number and capacity of providers that serve underserved communities. And the hopes of this project is to increase access to service for people who, so that they can receive services from providers that have their shared histories, languages, cultures, and norms. And this project just received approval in that January 24th approval. And so we are anxiously working on this process and hope to publish the RFPs for these funds shortly. The plan also includes a $12 million grant fund to combat challenges the state encounters related to attracting and maintaining direct care workers in the HCBS space. And to date, we have worked and surveyed stakeholders on strategies of how to utilize the funds, and we should be publishing a report in the coming days that identifies strategies that this committee can kind of think about grappling future investments with. Waiver Reimagine is also included in the plan, and this project consolidates the disability waivers and provides an individual budgeting model so that people have access to an equitable amount of funding. This project also is a workforce strategy because it enables people to self-direct and provide and seek non-traditional ways of seeking support. The plan also included $11 million for loan forgiveness for alcohol and drug counselors and mental health professionals serving MA beneficiaries. And this proposal will help increase access to mental health and SUD services across the state. And then lastly, the plan included a legislative task force on background studies, which seeks to improve the state's background studies requirements to ensure that we have both adequate protections for people receiving HCBS while also addressing the workforce challenges and disproportionate impacts of background studies. So an update on this is that the task force began meeting in October 2021, and they will have a first report due in March, with a final report due in December of this year. So due to the short timeline of the task force, they chose to form three subcommittees. One is DHS background studies data, another is reasons for disqualifications, and then a third, remedies for the issues the task force is seeing. So we hope to have a report on the work to date and the plan for the remainder of the task force in the March 2022 report. And with that, I think I'm going to kick it to Ms. Grom for some updates in the behavioral health space.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. And much of this is made possible from federal funding from the Biden administration. So we really want to thank President Biden and his team for giving us federal funds to do more work in home and community-based services. And a lot of thanks goes to our workers at our state agencies to help develop these proposals and to legislators who were champions of many of these proposals. And it was immense amount of work last year, but we just wanna showcase how gratifying it can be to do all of this, these key investments to really improve people's lives in the state. And before we go to Ms. Grom, I see Representative Albright, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Ms. Bailey, you may not have this information now, but I'm hoping that you could provide it to myself and the rest of the members of the committee shortly. But with the largesse of the ARP funds, and I understand that a significant amount of that money is dedicated towards one-time grants, one-time appropriations. I'm wondering if you either know it now or in the very near future, if you could provide the breakdown in terms of what amount of one-time money these emphases, these proposals represent, whether that they are represented from ARP money or from general fund money. And then what amount is appropriation and which amount are you intending to add to the base?
Did you get all those questions, Ms. Bailey? If you can, try to answer those that you can, and maybe you can follow up with Representative Albright after the committee as well. Ms. Bailey?
Yes, thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Albright. We can definitely get that information to you. I would say off the top of my head, you know, 60% of the funding were in those rate increases, and those were all ongoing. But I can get a detailed accounting for what is one-time money, what was ongoing, and what we're proposing to add to the base in the governor's budget.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Follow-up, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think as we've talked personally, Representative Schultz and I, this is probably the watershed moment for the legislature in terms of putting a good step of faith forward in terms of helping the healthcare community, particularly with the healthcare worker shortage. And I could go on, but I do want to make sure that the industry itself and the people that we are trying to support, are their expectations are managed appropriately so that we don't prop them up for one or two biennia, only to disappoint them when Mother Hubbard's cupboard is no longer full of food, you know, after the appropriation is gone, and we're wrestling with an ever-expanding base within our budget. So I fully support the efforts to make sure that our workers are compensated correctly. I just want to make sure that we do it with our eyes wide open for the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And, you know, the intent of investing in home and community-based services is to really reduce the cost of the long-term using nursing facilities, which is much more expensive. And so these key investments, hopefully, in the long term, will save the state money, and we can reinvest that in more home and community-based services and maintain these higher reimbursement rates. I see Chair Liebling has a question. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I really just, first of all, raised my hand to acknowledge and thank Ms. Bailey and DHS. I don't know how anyone could fail to notice in the presentation, and we lived through a lot of this, or some small portion of this with her, but they have done an incredible amount of work in a really short time. And the amount of creativity and engagement that she and her team have had is just out of this world. So, I mean, Minnesotans should be really thrilled to have such a team of people working for them, first of all. That just has to be said. And the other thing, I guess I just want to respond to what Representative Albright raised, and Representative Schultz, I think you mentioned, you responded very well to that, but this issue about you know, promises we can't keep is a theme I've been hearing for quite a few years. I heard that theme 10 years ago or so when the ACA was passed and we started helping people to get covered with MA who had never been covered before, and et cetera. And I think what we've seen is that, first of all, Minnesotans highly value being able to care for the most vulnerable. And we value, we all understand when we're talking about disabilities that we could all have one anytime. We're all one accident and one, you know, bad piece of bad luck away from having a disability and needing assistance ourselves. And living in a state where we value, you know, giving people not only care they need, but as much independence as they want is really important. So, you know, the future will be the future, and we'll deal with if we have a crisis and we have to make cuts, we'll deal with that when it comes. But I certainly would never think of not doing what we can do today because of what might happen sometime in the future. That just to me isn't my value. And I'm just thrilled that we're able to do these things. So thanks for giving me a moment with that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Liebling, I certainly share your concerns about fiscal responsibility going forward, but also recognizing that the needs are great in the current biennia. And I'm sure that people would appreciate a level playing field as opposed to one that has valleys that go on forever. And so that's what I'm trying to prevent, that people can be assured that if they walk down a certain path, that they are not disappointed by the pamphlet that they got before they started the trip. I do have one other question for Ms. Bailey, and this would be regard to the task force. I'm just wondering when the data pursuant to that will be released. I have not seen as much as what I was expecting, and I'm wondering when we could expect the full release of that data from that task force.
Ms. Bailey, I know how incredibly busy you all are, but do you have a date for that release of data?
Chair Schultz, Representative Albright, I'll have to get back to you. I don't have that data at this time.
Representative Albright.
I think when we're talking about licensure and background checks and the impediments that many who are trying to get into the workforce are being kind of blocked by that for any number of reasons, and trying to put together a way to streamline that process, I would hope that that information could be brought forward. I'm just wondering if in a follow-up, Ms. Bailey could identify what progress is being made in the tenor of those meetings that she's been holding with the task force. And I'll end with that.
I think Representative Mohler can answer part of that question. Representative Mohler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schultz, and thank you, Representative Albright, for asking about that. Representative Robbins and I serve on that task force, and DHS has provided a number of the data requests, and there is an LCC web page that should have a lot of that information posted there. And as Ms. Bailey mentioned, there is a preliminary report coming out, not until March. It's going to be a very high-level report because the task force still has a lot of work to do. But I just wanted to point out that there is that LCC website that has a lot of the information that the task force has received so far on it.
And I know DHS is working very hard with providers to make sure that they're reducing the barriers around background studies and fingerprints. So I know they're taking this very seriously, Representative Albright, and working very closely with our providers across the state. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on the exchange between Lead Albright and Chair Liebling, I guess it was just caused me to reflect. I mean, there's a basic question we face right now, which is, you know, do we meet needs now with resources now? And of course, keeping in mind this broader picture, I recognize Representative Albright's point projecting in the future. But I guess as I jump forward even into the future, I guess it feels like we also, to my mind, need to make a commitment to say that we're going to meet these needs going forward as well. And that if we're in more straitened or more challenging fiscal circumstances in the future, we want to make sure the most vulnerable people in our state are protected and lifted up in the future as well. So I guess I would even say that I guess I'd like to set an expectation for people who are vulnerable and people who need help, that we are going to be with them on the journey along the path in the future as well. And we're gonna do that together. We're a state that has resources because we've invested in people, invested in one another. And that needs to continue to be true in the future as well. So I guess I would say that our decisions now are not just about the decisions now sort of in spite of the future, but they need to be about decisions we're making all the way along as well. Anyway, thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Albright.
Representative Pinto, Representative Liebling. We are singing harmony to the same sheet of music. We both intend to use the same purposes to get and attain the same goal. Please understand, we may not be singing unison, but we are singing off the same sheet of music right now.
And I see Mr. Berg, our resident financial expert, is showing his face, so he may be able to answer some of the previous questions. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, I don't have an answer for the specific set of questions that Representative Albright asked, that the ongoing costs relative to only the HCBS package. But there is, that can be subsumed in a larger question, which is the tails on last year's bill. And for the entire bill, the HCBS package and everything else in the bill, the general fund tails for fiscal years 24 and 25 increased by $100 million above base for everything. Now, a caveat in that is, as Ms. Bailey mentioned, the federal funds need to be spent by, I believe it's March of 2024. So the ongoing costs in some cases that the general fund is picking up within that $100 million I mentioned is only for fiscal 25 and about 3 months of fiscal 24. So the full biennial cost of these HCBS items, it would show a little more than that. But as of when we passed the bill, the total cost for everything ongoing that was increased when the federal money runs out, as it was posed, is $100 million in the next biennium. Now, Ms. Bailey can show do that for just the HCBS items, and it will come to a different number, probably higher than that. But there are other things that happened in the bill as well. So I don't know if that helps, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. That may sound like a lot, but when you spend $16 billion in HHS, I don't know, it could be a rounding error, but We did some really great investments, and you have my commitment to continue investing in the people of Minnesota. And I know that myself and Representative Albright are going to work really closely to tackle all of these challenges that are facing the state and the people that live in it. So let's see. Let's end with questions for now. We'll pick it up questions back up after Ms. Graham's presentation. Ms. Graham, welcome to the committee, and thank you for all the hard work you're doing as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. I think we'll get our slides back up on the screen in a minute here. All right, thank you. So wanted to talk with the committee about a few implementation updates in our Community Supports Administration area. And I'm going to start with the behavioral health area. But before I do that, Ms. Bailey did mention that we just recently received kind of full approval for many of the items that I'll be talking about and covering in the next few slides. But we have been working in the background behind the scenes to really tee up all of the work that needs to occur and to sequence it based on kind of deadlines that are in law and that makes sense for us so that we can initiate the plans as soon as we got approval. And so that's what we're working on right now, is really setting those plans in action. We've done a lot of pre-planning work. So all that to say, just wanted to let you know that there's been extraordinary work on behalf of the staff at DHS, especially our policy experts and our managers and supervisors. I get the privilege of sharing some of these updates with you, but really it's all the credit to them. So moving to a few updates I thought would be helpful to talk about today. So first of which would be telehealth. Obviously this is one of the most prominent topics last session. And just kind of a background on what we all passed last session to refresh folks' memory. We removed the coverage limit of the 3 telemedicine services per enrollee per calendar week. And then we also authorized telehealth visits for audio and visual communication to satisfy the face-to-face requirements for a variety of services, including our certified community behavioral health clinics. And then we added a whole host of behavioral health professionals who can provide telehealth, or clarified that they can provide telehealth under our Minnesota healthcare program. So our mental health certified peer specialists, our recovery peers, our mental health rehab workers, licensed alcohol and drug counselors, to name a few. And then finally, we allowed for audio only to be provided for our medical assistance in Minnesota care enrollees through June 30th of 2023. And sort of related to that provision, we are going to be working with the Department of Commerce and Health to really study the impact of audio-only services and really getting a better understanding of how, you know, what the quality is and how people are experiencing that service and whether or not we should continue it beyond 2023. So in terms of implementation on this item, most of the work has been completed. We've had a provider manual has been updated. There might be a couple of pending updates that are near completion. But our provider communities have been notified of all of these updates. And really, many of our providers have been providing these services under our different flexibilities that we have through our executive orders previous to this. So it's been a pretty smooth transition. We are also, regarding the audio only, working with Wilder Research, and we've been conducting focus groups and interviews with medical assistants enrollees from certain communities, and also working with you know, high level informants in those communities who can really speak to the needs of the community. We've done a survey of our medical assistance enrollees, and then we're really engaging with our internal staff and with partners to interpret the data, understand what some of our recommendations might be, and then to share those recommendations with the legislature and others. So this is ongoing work still. I know our research scientists, some of them are working on Saturdays, really engaged in these discussions with people who use services. So really important initiative. Mobile crisis funding. So mobile crisis funding is can be a Medicaid billable service. Some parts of it are, but we have grant dollars that fund underinsured or uninsured individuals, as well as certain activities in those mobile crisis teams that aren't covered by MA. So for example, phone calls and phone screenings. And so these are really important grants. We've seen an unprecedented increase in calls for mobile crisis teams over the past 5 years, but also in particular over the pandemic period. So we are working on kind of finalizing some of our parameters to make sure that the new grant dollars that go out are completely in alignment with the allowable uses of our federal HCBS FMAP funding. And we'll be soon sending out an RFP to counties and tribes to determine what the new allocation amounts will be, and then we'll go ahead and amend their contracts to add those funds. For transition, oh, and I should say, maybe to Representative Albright, some of your questions, we do have a funding in the governor's 2022 budget recommendations for this particular proposal to continue those grant fundings beyond 2024 so that there isn't a cliff and we can continue to meet the needs in the community. Transition to community initiative. So this is a grant that helps people transition from more restrictive settings like Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, Security Hospital, other hospital settings to more community-based settings and really support people and some of their unique needs to thrive in the community. So this, again, we just received approval for, but staff have been doing outreach with our current grantees and have been kind of talking to them about how their current contracts would be modified once we got approval. And then we've been doing having a lot of internal conversations with direct care and treatment pre-admission staff to really make sure that we roll this out in a constructive and helpful way. And then since we received approval, we have a variety of positions that we are working on hiring. We have our internal process underway to get those positions hired. So we've got a data analyst and I think a grant contract analyst and then a diversion coordinator that we'll be looking to hire in the very near future now that we have approval. This provision, again, is included in the governor's budget 2022 recommendations to continue the funding beyond 2024. Substance use disorder rate increases and related provisions. So there was a lot that occurred last session as it relates to substance use disorder, which is great. Ms. Bailey did mention a few of the rate increases we have. So we had a 5% rate increase for rate add-ons, and those are for culturally responsive, disability-specific, and then family treatment populations. So that particular rate increase is pending a state plan amendment. It's with CMS. It was submitted in early January, and we're just waiting to hear back from them on that particular rate increase. We are working on developing communication so that once we get the increase approved, we can let providers know and make sure that folks can get that money. 1115 rate increases were also passed related to substance use disorder last session. So our 1115 substance use disorder demonstration is really focused on implementation of the American Society for Addiction Medicine levels of care, or ASAM levels of care, really trying to enhance evidence-based assessment criteria, and increase our standards for treatment coordination and making sure that people get the support they need as they move throughout their recovery journey. So this particular provision in the bill authorized rate increases for both residential and outpatient 1115 participants. And so it was a 10% increase. So from 10 to 20% for outpatient treatment services and 15 to 25% for inpatient services. So those enhanced rates are really on top of a base rate, and then they would also be on top of whatever, if there are population-specific rate add-ons that a provider would receive. So very significant investment, and looking forward to implementing those. We also, those are tied up in our state plan amendment as well at CMS. We did have one meeting with CMS recently about this particular provision, and we've been responding to questions. They've been wanting to understand what kind of evidence we have of meaningful steps to receive those rate enhancements. And we'll continue to work with CMS and to update, communicate with providers as soon as we get approval on that. And then lastly, wanted to mention recovery community organizations. These are really important organizations that are part of the continuum of care for substance use disorder. They're typically not a clinical type of service for people, but they really offer that support that people need from their peers oftentimes when they're in earlier and ongoing recovery. So we received approval for additional funding for our recovery community organization grants on the 24th. We have an RFP drafted. It's with review at the top level right now, and it will be published very soon as that RFP gets approved. Adult crisis stabilization. So this was a provision that the legislature was moving, I think, for the past couple of sessions, and it would establish a per diem rate for residential crisis services. Certain providers that that hadn't had a cost-based rate and really were struggling to meet the needs of the people that were utilizing their services. So this, again, was approved on January 24th by CMS, and we got our state plan approval pretty quickly on February 2nd. So that was kind of record time, it seemed like, for CMS. So really happy to hear that this one has been It's been approved. We are we've updated the MMIS rates so that the rates are current in that system, and we're working on reprocessing the claims that had dates of service on or after January 1st of 2022 to make sure that they get processed with the new rate. Mental health uniform service standards. Lots of conversation we've had about this last session. This is an initiative that aligns common standards really to reduce administrative burden and to refocus the standards on supporting quality and as well as equitable services. We received approval for this particular provision on January 24th as well. We have been working internally and with providers. We've had some webinars recently, and we'll continue those webinars through March of 2022. These provisions are effective July of 2022, so we're really just getting ready for launching that and making sure that we have the staff on hand to provide the new licensing oversight functions that were passed as part of this provision. I will also say that we have a technical bill that we'll be pursuing, a policy bill, just making some updates to this area of law that this committee may be seeing in the next couple of weeks as well. And then finally, our behavioral health rate study. We know that our behavioral health rates really do need to be assessed. They've not been holistically assessed in, I don't think, ever. We know that providers are really struggling to stay open and to provide services and struggling with workforce, as Ms. Bailey and others have noted as well. So this was a provision in the bill last year that required DHS to perform a rate study for all MA outpatient services as well as behavioral health rate services. And we kind of pulled in at least one residential service, so residential SUD services as well. So we've drafted an RFP. Well, we've been waiting for approval. We just got that approval a couple of weeks ago. And then late last week, I believe it was, we had a meeting with stakeholders to review the RFP, answer stakeholder questions, and we're awaiting feedback to potentially integrate some of the feedback from stakeholders in the RFP. And then we'll be issuing that in the next couple of weeks. So that work is really critical. It involves actuarial analysis and some pretty technical work. So we're looking forward to getting our contractors on board and providing recommendations to the legislature in both 2023 and 2024 on what those rates should look like. Moving to disability services.
Ms. Graham, I'm going to stop you there because Representative Robbins has had her hand up. So I'm assuming she has a question possibly on one of these items. Representative Robbins. Oh, you're muted. There you go.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Graham. Yes, going all the way back to the telehealth providers, just for a quick second, this is an issue I'm really interested in following, and you listed off several different tiers of providers. A couple of them I wasn't familiar with. So if in follow-up, you could just email me. Everybody who provides telehealth service and sort of a little description of all the different layers and what they receive for reimbursement. I would just like to personally have a better handle on this. So for a follow-up, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. And Ms. Graham is shaking her head, so I'm assuming she will follow up with you. And I'm glad you're very interested in that. So keep me apprised of what you discover. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Appreciate the opportunity. Ms. Graham, I just wanted to back up a little bit on when you were talking about the SUD, the 1115 rates. You were talking about that there was work being done for the increases there. Did all the waivers that are needed for the programs in the SUD area, were those all approved? And if they have not been approved yet by the feds, where are we in the process? And what are the plans if we're not able to get those waivers all approved?
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, the initial state spending plan, as Ms. Bailey mentioned, did kind of provide a little bit of a roadblock to implementing those rate increases, but we're working through that, and we think that we can hopefully find a solution. The waivers for the state plan amendment are still pending with CMS, so we're waiting for approval of those waivers, and as soon as we get the approval, we'll go ahead and work with the legislature if there's potential issues related to the spending plan and address them this session.
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had mentioned that there was one part that there's some issues that are still being worked out. Do you have an idea that the area that as how long it'll be before we know when that'll be resolved and how that might be resolved and what the dollar amounts might actually be involved with that?
Ms. Grom or Ms. Bailey?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, I would defer to Ms. Bailey on if there would be any fiscal impact. I know that the other body has been looking at options to address the issue that we've discussed earlier.
Ms. Bailey?
Yes, Representative Fisher, Chair Schultz. Yes, the specification in the CMS conditional approval essentially does not allow us to count certain spending that occurs in IMD. And so those rate increases, of course, span both IMD and not IMD settings. If we were to not include the spending in the IMD settings, it would reduce spending in the plan by about $2 million. Now, of course, our spending projections are much higher than what we're required to spend. And so we think a potential solution could be if the legislature chose to specify in some sort of bill this session that those increases are not part of the HCBS spending plan. The issue is last session, the bill made all of the appropriations contingent upon approval of the item in the spending plan. And so, you know, a cost neutral solution could be to just make it clear in the law that those appropriations are not contingent upon the decision in the plan.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Chair Fisher?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Ms. Bailey. If we need some policy along that lines, is that something that the department already has the language for, or is that something that we're gonna wait until we know as we go forward? Because it seems that if there's something that we could just do a bill to address that, maybe it's something we want to get going sooner versus later.
Yeah, I'm going to encourage you to work offline on this, work through it. I think some of us are aware of the problem, and it sounds like it may take a legislative solution.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Berg?
I believe the language that fixes this was added to the Senate version of the waiver extension bill in Senate Finance yesterday, which they then moved out to general orders. So I believe maybe the department can confirm that, but I think the fix is already sitting on general orders in the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Okay, Chair Fisher, we're gonna move on so we can get through Ms. Grom's presentation. Ms. Grom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the questions, Representative Fisher. I will breeze through the implementation updates for disability services in the interest of time. So Ms. Bailey talked about personal care assistance rate increases and the cost reporting that went along with those rate increases, truly historic investments. We know that PCA rates have gone largely untouched really over the past decade with compared to other home and community-based service rates. And we've seen that impact on workers. Some of our research shows that PCA workers have the lowest wage of any home and community-based service worker. And we know that we've heard from people who are really struggling to find PCA. So very appreciative of this 10% enhanced rate increase for PCA and the implementation of a PCA rate framework that once funded will provide long-term sustainable rates and help PCA rates get to parity with other services. So this rate increase has been implemented. I believe it was effective October 1st of 2021. We were able to get that one done on time through some conversations with CMS to make sure that we could complete it on time and we hit the mark. So we're really pleased to report that that has been implemented. We also have cost reporting that we're working on. Staff have been working with our Minute partners to develop the platform for reporting. We've been drafting a cost reporting tool working across teams, and we think that cost reporting tool will be done this month. We're on track to launch cost reporting on time, and we do plan to integrate the reporting platform with existing systems for reporting in other areas, for example, DWRS, for folks who might be doing cross reporting, and then as well as for our own purposes for internal data analysis. Waiver Reimagined, Ms. Bailey mentioned this important effort last session. One of the items that was funded by our HCBS FMAP was the Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee. And that committee has been appointed. We have a first meeting scheduled for March 3rd. And that's a committee that's really going to help us provide feedback to make sure that we're hearing from people who use services, we're hearing from providers, and construct Waiver Reimagined Phase 2, and in particular, the individualized budgets in a way that works for people, and implement that in a very, in a helpful way, a slow-paced way. So I think our implementation is going to start around 2024, but this this Waiver Reimagined Advisory Committee will really help us shape that implementation and make sure it works for people. Parenting with a disability, this is a proposal that I think many of you on this committee are familiar with and have worked on for the past several years at least. We have some fantastic self-advocates who've really been promoting this work. And it's really about understanding, you know, that we do have parents with disabilities who access our services, who access PCA and our HCBS waiver services. And they sometimes do need support with parenting activities. Traditionally, Medicaid doesn't pay for services when they're not related, when they're not tied directly to the person's disability, and they might look at, you know, supporting someone with parenting support as really not supporting the person, but rather the child. So we really want to be innovative and look at ways to maybe include parenting support, for example, as an activity of daily living, and allow PCA to cover it. It's really, I think, reflective of systemic bias to assume that we would have that people with disabilities that we support in our programs aren't parents. So we're really looking forward to that work. This just got approval. We have a contract that's almost ready to be finalized that we'll be working on to study the issue and make some recommendations. HCBS technology grants. These were grants that were passed last session for HCBS providers to provide technology assistance to people with disabilities as well as older adults who didn't have access to the resources that they might need to use remote services or telehealth. I'll note we did issue a legislative report on this topic. I think it was last summer. I'm happy to follow up and share that with members, but it does include some important recommendations related to HCBS technology needs. So I think we still have some work to do in this area, and we'd be glad to engage in conversations with members. This funding does end in 2024, so right now we have an RFP in process that should be going out soon to make sure we can get the funds out to providers, and hopefully we can work with many of you in the legislature to extend funding here. Planning for the sub-minimum wage phase-out task force. The last session there was a task force established in law to help, as well as provider reinvention grants to support providers who are already adjusting their business models to transition fully to community-based employment. The vast majority of our HCBS providers do not operate under sub-minimum wage, what we call 14C certificates, but Minnesota still has the highest rate of people working in sub-minimum wages in the nation. I know the committee saw a presentation from the demographer maybe last week or the week prior that showed rates of poverty for people with disabilities. It's a significant problem, so this is an important conversation to be having right now. We've seen since the end of last session, two additional states phase out sub-minimum wage, North Carolina and Delaware. We know that Texas has already phased it out, so we're looking forward to the conversation as we're hearing activity at the federal level and potentially plans on the federal level to phase this out. So we have had our first sub-minimum wage task force meeting that happened on February 8th. And we've had a variety of RFPs that we've executed to support this work, to help us with making sure that we have appropriate communications and that we're integrating the voices of all perspectives in this work. That's an important part of this work in our report to the legislature. We also have our grant RFPs out, I believe, one for providers who have 14C certificates that want to transition to competitive employment. And then we also added, getting feedback from the community, we added a grant for providers that have heard about the policy direction of the state and have given up their 14C certificate, but still maybe have a need to have access to some of those funds to support the transition. Then I'll move to the next slide. So a couple of housing-related updates. So last session, we received funding for people who are transitioning to their homes after experiencing homelessness. Two ways to get this money out under the bill last year and funded by the HCBS FMAP one of which was through our medical assistance housing stabilization service benefit, and then the second of which was through our community living infrastructure grant, which are grants to counties and tribes to support people making those transitions to their own home. So through both of these programs, we'll be able to support people depending on if they're eligible for housing stabilization services or not, to set up rental and security deposits for them, to pay for utility setup, furniture costs, and things that they really need to make a helpful transition to their own home. So we just received approval for both of these. In terms of the housing stabilization benefit, we have a state plan amendment that is almost drafted and finalized. We're just working with our Minute partners to finalize the date of when we can go live with this. And then once we get that, we'll be able to put the amendment out for public comment. So I think we're hoping to have that done by the end of the month, hopefully. In terms of community living infrastructure, we are just reviewing the RFP for that, and we'll be getting that issued soon so that the community can get access to those funds. And then sober housing recommendations, my last implementation update for the committee here today. So we were required last session to develop recommendations for increasing access to sober housing programs. And really taking a look at the oversight in some of these programs. There's been some concerns recently. I know there's been some heartbreaking testimony in this committee. There's been some media coverage of, you know, incidents where people had, say the least, less than ideal outcomes at some of these sober housing settings. So we have engaged with stakeholders. We've had our first work group meeting, I think either yesterday or the day prior. We have 7 meeting dates planned. We have 3 contracts executed to help support in this work. And we've been working with a number of participants. It's a pretty diverse group of folks that we've been working with. So we're excited about what these recommendations will look like. I think they're due in September of 2022. So we'll be sharing those soon with all of you. Immediate next steps on this, we do need to complete our permission application from the IRB to begin interviewing people and families who use these services. And then we do still see a need to continue to seek participation from diverse groups that are using these services so we can get a comprehensive feedback. And that's all I had. I can transition to back to Ms. Bailey.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. Ms. Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Ms. Grom. I'm just going to kind of finish off with a few slides. You know, given the quick turnaround that we had to compile the spending plan, we had to submit it to CMS before we were able to do kind of a fully vetted public comment process. So I wanted to share with the committee what that public comment process was and the kind of feedback we received as you consider kind of future reforms in this space. So we had a public comment period between July 9th and August 12th and received a total of 73 unique responses from a variety of perspectives, such as people with disabilities, parents, providers, counties, and advocacy organizations. The most common comment was, of course, related to increasing direct care staff wages. So I would like to commend the committee for a large portion of this spending plan was in rate increases that directly increased the staff wages. Most of the comments really noted areas of support in the plan. Those included rate increases, PCA changes. So we had a whole multitude of changes, including rates, but also transportation and other items. The technology grants that Ms. Grom mentioned, strategies to support people to live in their own home, and the provider capacity grants. There were some comments that recommended other ideas or wishes that we had included more items that related to access to affordable housing for people with disabilities, increasing the hours available to people and budgets available to people on the programs, and then strategies to increase access to competitive employment. So last slide, next steps and further policy development. So our next steps, of course, are implementing these newly approved HCBS initiatives and just getting federal approval. We're really excited to begin kind of paving the way in full force on all of the items. We also, as Ms. Graham mentioned on a few, have recommendations in the governor's budget to continue some of the time-limited HCBS investments, and those included things such as the mobile crisis grants, transition to community, the community living infrastructure grants, funding those transitional supports for people receiving housing stabilization services. The governor's recommendations also kind of build on the HCBS investments and increase even more investments in other spaces in HCBS. For example, the behavioral health space, which includes over $133 million in mental health and behavioral health supports, and over $100 million, $133 million in housing and $100 million in investments in the behavioral health space, which includes increases to mental health supports and ensuring investments in the opioid space go to disproportionately impacted communities. So I encourage the committee to look at those recommendations in detail. And of course, we have the $115 million workforce incentive fund to build upon strategies for the workforce crisis. And then lastly, I would kind of say that these are historical investments, particularly the rate increases, but we should work together on a comprehensive approach going forward to kind of build upon them to kind of target the challenges we're seeing in this space. So thank you for having us today and allowing us to go over these important initiatives.
Well, thank you both for all the work you continue to do for our state. And I'll just mention that I'm fortunate to be part of the Milbank Memorial Fund, which is a nonprofit organization that's committed to improving population health. I'm part of their fellowship program. So I've been meeting with legislators from across the country, different states, and folks that work in HHS agencies across states. And I have to say, it sounds like Minnesota is a leader in pushing out these federal funds. And I'm gonna assume and guess that many states are contacting our agency folks to find out what Minnesota is doing to make these key investments. So now I can just send them a link to this hearing instead of answering all their questions, but I'm really proud of our state and proud of everyone who's been working on these initiatives. Representative Bonner.
Yeah, I briefly just wanted to say thank you to the folks over at DHS. One thing that was in this presentation that I really, really appreciated is some of the additional input on some of our successes, as well as some of the status on some of those things that are in progress. I know we work hard to pass legislation, but we often don't get an opportunity to really hear how those things are implemented and what's happening with each of those initiatives along the way. So I found that really valuable. Certainly, I can catch up with you offline to get some more information on that new reporting platform. As an IT person, that's really of interest to me, but also really grateful for the work on the parenting with a disability waivers as well. I know Ms. Via Vicente has been a dedicated champion on that particular front. So many great things in that piece, and I really appreciate that and hope we'll continue to have that segment going forward. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. Our second item on the agenda is to get an update on the Age-Friendly Minnesota work that's happening. So we're going to turn over to the first testifier. I have Sherry Pugh. She's the chair of Age Friendly Minnesota Council. Are you with us? And is your audio working? I'm not seeing Ms. Pugh. I think we'll go to, I see Ms. Stockard is on. Ms. Stockard?
Chair Schultz, Nicole Stockard with the Department of Human Services. I think Sherry's audio, like you mentioned, may not be working. We have Rajan Moon lined up to start the presentation. Okay. If she doesn't come on.
Thank you, Ms. Stockard. So we'll go to Professor Moon. He's the Age-Friendly Minnesota Council member. I'm seeing Sherry Pugh is on now.
Okay, can you hear me?
We can, Ms. Pugh. Welcome to the committee. We're so glad your audio is working.
And I'm so lucky to have Rajan as a backup. He's wonderful. Yes, please forgive me.
Please introduce yourself for the committee and then just proceed with your testimony. We can see your slides.
Sure. Okay. Good morning. My name is Sherry Pugh, and I'm the chair of Age Friendly Minnesota and a former board member of the Minnesota Board on Aging. So I was appointed by the governor in 2019. to chair this committee, which met its first meeting in February 2020. And that was the only time we saw each other face to face, because as you know, things have changed in our world. So just to give a little background on what has transpired, back in 2017, there was Minnesota was looking at its 2030 plan at the Board on Aging. And in that time period, became very aware of this really interesting movement, both nationally and globally, around age-friendly, and pursued finding out what it would mean for the state to become that sort of agency. So we proceeded in applying for some initial information and sharing that with the governor, who then in 2019 actually signed an executive order creating our commission. One of the beauties of our commission is that it's six active advocates, citizens in the state who are engaged in age related work, and eight state agencies. So we have this wonderful collaboration of people from a wide variety of positions who are all dealing with issues affecting older Minnesotans. In 2020, the council began meeting, and at that time we came up with our recommendations for why Minnesota should become an age-friendly state, and those recommendations giving a framework. Important in our recommendations was, obviously the first one was to apply to be a state agency, age-friendly state. But the second one was our diversity, equity, and inclusion, which we spent a lot of time about. And I want to talk about, because a lot of times people immediately go to, this is just about cultural groups. But we felt in the aging community, and I think you heard from the demographer, we know that the reality is 90% plus of the elders in the state of Minnesota are not people of color or cultural groups. And so, but we did know that we have this other group and some other smaller groups, but our elders who live in greater Minnesota have significant disparities which they face. And so we felt it was important that we identify them, as well as low income, people with disabilities, in our diversity, equity, inclusion as we move forward. And that makes us be really accountable as we do our work and we look at projects and review everything to say, are all of these groups within our older Minnesotans being addressed equally? And how can we change those things if they're not? In 2021, we want to thank you, the legislature, for passing a bill that gave us authorization to move forward in our plan. We had submitted the plan to AARP, but your legislation really gave us directions on pursuing policy. And those three policy areas that we're most interested in pursuing focus on technology, because we feel that technology is the last, it's kind of like how electricity was in the 50s. When everyone got electricity, it was equal around the country. And we know now that when everyone can get broadband, it will really even out some of the inequities, especially for those of our elders who live in greater Minnesota. And also we wanted to look at transportation issues. In Minnesota, we have this great network statewide all over in little small towns, even the little town I live in, where volunteers have come together to provide transportation for those in need of that help. But there were existing rules and laws that really sort of prohibited those volunteers from being able to continue doing that work at a reasonable, affordable level. And the legislature responded and gave us legislation to address that. So we will continue to work with that group, but and continue to work with the broadband groups as we try to make sure that all older Minnesotans have access to broadband, and that it's affordable access, and that transportation becomes a benefit and not something that becomes a burden to them. So now we're in 2022, and we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We're in the process of hiring a new executive director and grants manager, because in that legislation you passed last year, we were directed to launch our grant program by the end of 2022, so that we can help cities across the state create their own ways of addressing becoming an age-friendly community. And I also think it's so timely because I'm on the city council of Mound, where I live, and we're doing new sidewalks. And so I raised my hand and I said, well, you know, we need to make sure those sidewalks are walkable for seniors, that the color of the sidewalks help them distinguish between the street and the curb. So even in when people think about the infrastructure bills, there is a vital and important part for older Americans, Minnesotans, to play in those policy decisions at the local level. We also are, with our state partners, reviewing their processes and policies for how to address emergencies, because that was one of the recommendations. We felt we needed to make sure we have a strong state program that addresses our elders in states of emergency. And COVID has been, on one hand, very good, because it's allowed people to do and see new remedies and identify some issues that we really didn't know before that we now address. So food security became a big role, and there's lots of learnings around food security that we have, but in all of the departments, they're sharing with us, and we will take those learnings and look to produce something statewide that weaves together the various agencies and being a good steward of emergency preparedness in the state. So I think I'll kind of end that. That's kind of brings you up to date with where we're at now. We're hiring, getting ready to do our grant program, but we also have a lot of partners, and Dr. Rajan Moon is here from the University of Minnesota. He will talk to you about what universities and health systems are doing, which ties into the age-friendly efforts. And then Kathy Lear, the new director of the AARP, who gave us the final recognition of being a state age-friendly community, we'll also talk, and then I'll wrap up the end. So, Rajan.
Thank you, Ms. Pugh. Professor Moon, welcome to our committee. Just state your name for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rajan Moon. I'm a member of the Age Friendly Council, and I'm affiliated with the University of Minnesota. And I'm very glad that Council Chair Pugh's technology was able to work. She's much more eloquent as a local elected official to speak with you. I'm more accustomed to a rowdy classroom of students who I have to fight for their attention. So thank you again. Thank you for the opportunity really to provide an update on the work of the Governor's Council for an Age-Friendly Minnesota. If you can go to the next slide. Like my colleagues on this panel, I'm really optimistic that the demographic shift being experienced here in Minnesota really provides us with an unprecedented opportunity to support our local communities and chart a course for our future. And that isn't to say that it's all going to be easy. We do and will continue to face challenges. And that's the core of the work of the Governor's Council, helping communities understand their needs and really plan for their futures. Next slide, please. At the Governor's Council, we've been exploring this concept of age-friendly ecosystems. This ecosystem leverages the benefits of many initiatives occurring in communities across our state. My colleague, Kathy McClear, the state director of AARP Minnesota, we'll talk a bit more about age-friendly states and communities in just a few minutes. We didn't want to bury the lead that we are now enrolled in the global network, so you will hear that. But I thank Ms. McClear in her announcement that she'll be giving in just a couple of minutes. But there are so many other components of age-friendliness that really complement this framework. For example, in Minnesota, two schools, the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and St. Cloud State University, are enrolled in the global network of age-friendly universities who commit to expand access to lifelong learning opportunities, ensure students are prepared to work in a rapidly aging society, and support a robust portfolio of academic research in gerontology and geriatrics. We also have the engagement of acute care settings like clinics and hospitals, which are adopting the age-friendly health systems framework. A leader in this, the Minnesota Geriatric Workforce Enhancement Program, is collaborating with community clinics to ensure that older adults benefit from really the best and most promising practices in geriatric healthcare. And all of these initiatives are flexible and customizable so that local communities, whether they be towns, cities, counties, businesses, faith-based, nonprofit, or other, can use what works for them. In the end, they're all moving towards the same goal of truly an age-friendly state. Next slide. The Governor's Council on an Age-Friendly Minnesota is comprised of representatives from 8 state agencies and 6 community members who are connected and passionate about age-friendly communities. And Council Chair Pugh described those individuals, me being one of them as well. The other state agencies include the Board on Aging, the Departments of Health, Veterans Affairs, Employment and Economic Development, the Housing Finance Agency, the Department of Commerce, Transportation, and Human Services. Next slide, please. As Council Chair Pugh noted, we've been busy over the last couple of years building the foundation to launch Minnesota into the next phases of our age-friendly work. Most recently, we've tackled the topic of emergency and disaster preparedness from the vantage point of older Minnesotans. Next slide. In 2020, we published a report with 8 recommendations to continue to move Minnesota forward. The full report is available on our website, and I'm happy to report that critical parts are well underway. With the aid of, hopefully soon, a council executive director, we will be able to expedite the work. Next slide, please. In the next year and beyond, we'll continue to support local communities, listening to their needs and advocating on their behalf. We'll work to develop a sustainable infrastructure so our critical initiatives don't end just at the time when Minnesota needs more efforts in age-friendly work. And finally, we'll continue to engage state agencies to establish benchmarks and measures for their age-friendly work. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony today, and I welcome any questions and would be happy to hand it over to my colleague, Ms. McClear, as well.
Thank you, Dr. Moon. We'll go to Ms. McClear, and then we'll hopefully have time for a question or two. Ms. McClear, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
And then good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair Schultz, members of the committee. My name is Kathy McClear, and I'm the State Director for AARP Minnesota. And on behalf of AARP's 640,000 members in the state and all older Minnesotans, we appreciate the opportunity to speak today to ensure that Minnesota is really prepared to meet the growing health, financial, and social needs of our aging population and to support the efforts of the Governor's Council on Age-Friendly. So we can go to my first slide. And AARP does applaud and thank the legislature and Governor Walz for a continued commitment to being an age-friendly state. And as has been said this morning, I am really pleased to share that as of January 3rd, Minnesota became the 10th state in the nation to join the AARP network of age-friendly states and communities. Next slide. I'm also pleased to share that we do have 14 communities across Minnesota that have also enrolled in the network, with new communities expressing interest on a regular basis. So the AARP Network of Age-Friendly States and Communities provides a structured process that guides change and really serves as a catalyst to educate, encourage, promote, and recognize improvements that benefit residents of all ages and life stages. Enrollment in the network provides member states and communities with the resources to become more age-friendly by tapping into national and global research, planning models, and best practices. The AARP Age-Friendly Network encourages states, counties, cities, towns, and rural areas to prepare for the rapid aging of our population and encourages elected officials and local leaders to focus on and strengthen the features and services that help make communities livable for all residents of all ages from cradle through retirement. Next slide. These are frequently referred to as the 8 domains of livability, which include community support and health services, outdoor spaces, transportation, housing, social participation, respect and inclusion, civic participation, and employment,
and communication and information. And I will also add that the council, as Ms. Pugh mentioned earlier, adopted an additional domain around emergency preparedness. These domains have a significant impact on the well-being of older adults and are used by communities to organize their work and really focus on what's important. So my final slide, enrolling in the network is not an ending. It is really the first step in a multi-year process. And Minnesota has completed phase one by submitting the application along with a letter of support from Governor Walz indicating that commitment to the age-friendly network. Phase two includes four steps. First is establishing that mechanism to involve older people and include the establishment of the governor's age-friendly council. The second is a baseline assessment of the age friendliness of the state, which is already in progress as well. Third, which is the next step in the process that the council will need to undertake, is the development of a community-wide action plan based on the findings of that assessment, and then to identify the indicators of success so that progress can be monitored against that action plan. So for example, applying an aging lens for planning, process and decision-making, taking actions that create an enabling operational and policy environment for the state itself and local communities. Upon that approval of the action plan, network members are then required to submit annual updates showing movement toward and a full 5-year evaluation of outcomes, which is phase three in the process. So some successful outcomes would include procedural, regulatory, or policy updates, including legislative actions, providing funding for age-friendly priorities, and continued inclusion and engagement of older adults throughout the age-friendly cycle. Upon completion of phase three, Minnesota will be able to continue membership in the network by entering into further planning and implementation and evaluation cycles. AERP Minnesota looks forward to and remains committed to continued collaboration and partnership with lawmakers and the Governor's Council on Age-Friendly to provide support as the state moves through this process. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I would also be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McClear, for joining us today. I'm excited about this initiative, and I have one question that maybe for Ms. Pugh. Have the RFPs been issued yet for communities to apply for the grant funds? And you're muted, Ms. Pugh. You can unmute.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer the question as well.
Okay, Professor Moon, go ahead.
Yes, the RFPs have not yet been released. The money was held up a little bit in the Medicaid HCBS spending plan with the FMAP funds, which you just had quite a wonderful report. So now that we've received approval, we'll be hiring the executive director and establishing the criteria for the RFPs with a goal to get them out as soon as possible.
Well, please send me an email when those are ready. I'm eager to see what the community's response will be. Any Absolutely. Questions from members? We only have a few minutes left. I'm not seeing any questions. Well, thank all of you for testifying today and for the work you're doing across our state. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pugh. So members, we will be meeting tomorrow, and we are going to get an update from DHS on children and family services. And then we're going to hear two bills, House Files 3259 and 3269. So I'm not seeing any other questions. Thanks again, members, for joining us. Have a great rest of your day, and we are adjourned.